I remember when he wrote Young Frankenstein, the outline for Young Frankenstein, he had rented a house in West Hampton and I was staying with him. And he had this long yellow legal pad and he wrote in blue ink. And I remember seeing the title on the yellow page in big letters, Young Frankenstein. And then that's all I ever saw on the pad for 2 or 3 days. He didn't write anything.
There are certain performers who freeze in time. Elvis, Audrey Hepburn, Sammy Davis Jr., Judy Garland. When you close your eyes and you think of these celebrities, you see an image. And that's how you remember them forever. Gene Wilder is the same. When I close my eyes, I see his tumbleweed locks, his ocean-deep blue eyes, and that sly, sweet smile. But I also see madness, mystery, and mischief. Gene is my Frankenstein, my Wonka, my Leo Bloom. But as I got to know him, he became so much more. He became my friend with a bit of a romantic streak, my voice of reason, and my sense of stability. And the best way to get to know him better was through his nephew slash adopted son, Jordan Walker Perlman.
And then I remember I saw him and he suddenly was riding away and he would take breaks and he would take breaks to bake bread. And he was baking rye bread once. And I don't know, what was I, 4? I don't know. And I guess he thought I was bored and I wasn't, because I was always just happy if I was with him. But he started to pretend that the rye bread in the oven could talk. And he would open the oven door and say, hello, hello. And I looked around and I said to him, there's something fishy going on around here. And he started laughing. And then for the next hour, he would open the oven door and pretend to be the rye bread. And the rye bread would say, fishy, fishy. And that from then on, his nickname for me was Fishy.
I am sure a few of us can relate to the escapism baking bread can provide under extreme circumstances. I think the more you learn about Gene, you may have more in common than you realize. Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie Okupniak. Gene Wilder wasn't always Gene. He was born Jerome Silberman in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Worlds apart from Hollywood. His mother, Jean, was often sick. She had complications from a rheumatic heart disease. And when Jerome was 8, his mother's doctor told him, "Don't ever argue with your mother. You might kill her. Try to make her laugh." Imagine that. Your mother's doctor warning you you could kill her. So, Jerome did what he thought could help. He started to perform skits and perfect different accents. He wanted to entertain and amuse her and help her forget, if ever so briefly, the sadness of her circumstances. And this was Jerome's introduction to acting. His mother thought he needed a little bit more structure, so she sent him to a military academy in California. But he was only there for 1 year after he was brutally bullied and abused for being the only Jewish student. So he returned to Milwaukee for high school. He saw his sister Corinne performing in local theater and became inspired. Theater made Gene feel free. He followed his sister's lead and got his first acting role as the servant Balthazar in Romeo and Juliet. He wasn't sad about his circumstances, and he didn't feel guilty for being happy. He felt comfort in being someone else. Gene went to the University of Iowa and majored in theater And when he graduated, he traveled to England to study acting and fencing at the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School. Fencing may have started as a credit in Jerome's acting CV, but he grew to become an impressive swordsman.
He was also the first American to win the fencing championship in London. And so he was an expert fencer. So he was very physical and very athletic. And that also made its way into his acting. 2 years ago, I think, maybe a little longer, Errol Flynn's fencing instructor, who was the fencing instructor to a lot of actors, died. I suppose he was well into his 90s. And he said that he named his three best pupils, and Gene was one of them.
In 1956, Jerome was drafted into the Army and became a medic to the Department of Psychiatry and Neurology at Valley Forge General Hospital in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. He worked in treating psychiatric patients. Once he was discharged, Jerome went to New York to chase his dream. He went to the Lee Strasberg Acting School and was confronted by his past. He admitted to himself he couldn't see Jerome Silberman up in lights. And after careful consideration, Jerome became Gene Wilder. Wilder, after the playwright Thornton Wilder, and Gene, from a character in a Thomas Wolfe novel, but also as a tribute to his mother. Gene was doing well as an actor. He supported himself with odd jobs and teaching fencing occasionally, but he was performing pretty regularly, both on and off Broadway. Gene was in a play on Broadway when a chance encounter backstage would change his life forever.
He was doing a play called Mother Courage with Anne Bancroft. And he was in a serious role. And Anne was dating Mel at the time. And Mel came backstage and he was wearing a Navy coat, an American Navy coat, the long blue-black coats, which they used to call a pea coat. And Gene met Mel, and Gene knew who Mel was, but was always a little shy. And so he said, oh, that's a great pea jacket you're wearing. And Mel said, you know, they used to call them urine jackets, but they didn't sell. And that made Gene laugh. And then they became friendly, and Mel said, I have two things to tell you. One is, I know you don't realize it, but you look kind of funny, and so you would be good in funny roles. You just can't help it. You're one of those guys. You've got a funny face about you. And then he said, and I'm writing a screenplay called Springtime for Hitler, and I want you to play the second lead. And then Mel never mentioned it again for 3 years. But they continued to be occasionally in touch. And then Mel called and said, you didn't think I forgot about you, did you? I've got the money and I'm doing it. It's now called The Producers. And that's how he and Mel went from knowing each other to becoming not just friends. He thought of Mel as his older brother, too.
Gene was getting some screen time before The Producers with TV work and a small role in Bonnie and Clyde. But The Producers catapulted him into leading man trajectory. His role as neurotic Leo Bloom earned him an Oscar nomination and a proud place in cinematic history.
Please don't jump on me.
I'm not gonna jump!
Will you get a hold of yourself?
Don't touch me! Don't touch me!
Gene was doing well. He had just gotten married to his second wife and work was steady. So much so, he was having to pick and choose roles offered to him. But the role he is most recognized for was not a commercial success.
He wasn't a movie star when he did Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. That was his first real solo lead role in a movie. And he would have turned it down because he needed to know that he could really do it. And by asking Mel Stewart to do that unpredictable thing in the beginning, he set the tone for the character he wanted that character to be unpredictable. That's why the part where he comes out in the cane and limps and then does a somersault, that wasn't in the script. That was, he said to Mel Stewart, I'll only do this movie if I can come out walking and limping with a cane and then do a somersault. And Mel Stewart, the director, said, why? And he said, because then the audience will never know whether I'm lying or telling the truth until the end. And not only was he right about that, but the extraordinary thing is every movie he had been in up until then was a terrible flop commercially and some of them artistically.
Welcome, my friends. Welcome to my chocolate factory. Would you come forward, please?
When I went to see Willy Wonka, I came out and I said, I understood everything except how you got behind the screen. And he told that story all the time.
Mothers who saw the film saw the dark side of Willy Wonka. I mean, when you think about it, it's a man who runs a candy factory that children die in. But the kids who watched it, they understood. And it's those kids who generation after generation have shown it to their kids, and they've loved it.
I've got a perfect puzzle for you.
The weird and wonderful world of Willy Wonka gave Gene a Golden Globe nomination and decades of a dedicated fan base. Gene had momentum on his side, and as his career progressed, he became a risk taker. He starred as the sheep sleeping psychoanalyst in Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask.
I took Daisy off to a little cove, and there, under the Armenian sky, had sexual intercourse.
With the sheep?
Naturally.
Oh, God.
It was the greatest lay I ever had.
Then, he perfected his quick draw as the right-hand man of Sheriff Bart in Blazing Saddles.
I must have killed more men than Cecil B. DeMille. Got pretty gritty. I started to hear the word draw in my sleep.
It was a great success, and the second collaboration with Mel Brooks. Between takes, Gene was writing his own comedic masterpiece, and Mel noticed his friend being distracted.
Part of his inspiration was practicality, writing a role and writing a movie for himself. But I think the other strain in him is he was always loved the James Whale Frankenstein movies. And like a lot of things in his life, I think he always wanted things to have a happy ending. And I think he thought, what would the Frankenstein movie be like if there was a happy ending and the monster's okay and the doctor's okay and the monster can get his brain right?
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits?
And I think that was the inspiration for him. And then he had 10 pages. And then, you know, he wasn't supposed to be in Blazing Saddles. That was an accident. But then he was in Blazing Saddles and he was continuing to write Young Frankenstein. And Mel saw what he was doing. And Mel started to ask about it. And then his agent at the time was also representing Peter Boyle and Marty Feldman, so it all came together. But my guess is that the initial inspiration was create a great role for himself as an actor and also see a Frankenstein movie with a happy ending. If you watch Young Frankenstein, and you watch Young Frankenstein side by side as a double feature with James Whale's Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, all three brilliant films. Look at Colin Clive's performance in Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, and it's actually on the nose funnier than Gene's performance in Young Frankenstein, which is very romantic and very classical. And the funny parts in it are because he's playing it so straight and gothic and romantic.
Are there any questions before we proceed?
I have one question, Dr. Frankenstein.
That's Frankenstein.
I beg your pardon?
My name It's pronounced Frankenstein.
There wasn't a single movie he did that would come close to his sense of pride and satisfaction in Young Frankenstein. Mel said to him, come with me, come with me, come to the editing room, then do this, watch this. And Gene said, why are you telling me all this? And Mel said, because you're going to want to direct next to protect your work. And, you know, Gene had a lot of things that he would be the first to tell you were there all the time that he wasn't conscious of. And maybe directing was one, but I never heard him talk about directing until that experience. And then the very next film he did was The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother, which he wrote and directed. And then he directed several films after that. And he loved directing. I don't think after Sherlock and World's Greatest Lover, he ever found quite his match with material as a director-actor.
Young Frankenstein was a tremendous success. Gene was even nominated for an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. The writing bug was firmly latched onto Gene, and the next organic step was directing. He wrote, starred, and directed The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother in 1975 and The World's Greatest Lover in 1977. Neither were box office hits and had scathing reviews.
They were going to follow Young Frankenstein with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And then they heard that Monty Python was going to do it. And so they put it aside. And then Gene did Sherlock and Mel did High Anxiety. And they didn't work again. But it wouldn't have been surprised me if they did. But they remained friends forever.
I would have donated most of my vital organs to have seen a collaboration between Gene and Mel for Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde.
Well, Gene wouldn't have let you donate most of your vital organs. That's the good news. The bad news is Mel would have taken them all on your tonsils too and then made
the
movie.
We're going to take a short break to list my vital organs for sale on the dark web. But when we get back, we'll hear all about the love of Gene's life.
Hey, everybody. How you doing? It's crazy, right? Do you feel a little bit boxed in with lockdown, pandemic, uncertainty? I don't blame you. There's so much clouding our happiness, our security, our structure. It's gone. And you know, there's so many other things also that are frozen in time. Do you feel like you can't move forward? You can't achieve the goals that you set out for yourself? I don't blame you. But there's help out there. In fact, that's what I want to tell you about. Our sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp will sit down with you, assess your needs, and they're going to match you with a licensed professional therapist. And you can work with them in under 48 hours. You can then log on to an account that you set up with BetterHelp anytime, and you can schedule weekly video counseling sessions or telephone sessions. You can also send a message to your counselor and get really quick responses. This isn't a crisis line. This is not self-help. It's professional counseling done securely online. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional counseling, and financial aid is available. And BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. So head over to betterhelp.com/lived and get a 10% discount off your first month of therapy. That's betterhelp.com/lived. Over 1 million people have turned to BetterHelp so that they can take charge of their mental health. And you can too with an experienced professional. Find out more at betterhelp.com take care of yourselves.
Gene may have had a series of flops, but that wouldn't stop him. A thick skin is a requirement in this industry. Gene would channel his frustration on the court.
He played a lot of tennis and swimming and riding. And at night, his bedroom was in the back, but my bedroom in LA was in the front next to the living room. And in the living room was a piano. And at night, sometimes I'd stay up when he did this, or sometimes I'd go to bed. He'd play the piano and smoke a half a cigarette. After a couple of years, he quit the cigarette, and he'd have a Le Cassis. And that relaxed him, playing Mozart or Beethoven, having a nightcap, and smoking maybe a half a cigarette.
Though Gene had traction as a comic actor, he always considered himself an actor first.
All of this energy that was in his life manifested itself on screen in ways that made audiences laugh. And that he did gravitated towards it. And as a writer actor, he gravitated towards it, towards humor, I mean. But he would never in a million years would he consider himself a comic. And never would he consider himself a comedian, ever. He would consider himself an actor. Once in a while, he would say comic actor, or somebody else said comic actor, he wouldn't correct them. But that's not how he thought of himself. And if you see his work, certainly the best of his work, it's always truth-based, but that's what made it so funny.
Gene began being cast across from the edgy, young comedian Richard Pryor. Richard was well known for pushing boundaries with his comedy, but he was also very open and honest about his drug addictions. When Gene and Richard were on screen, it was kismet. Gene described it as almost like a sexual chemistry, without the sex. He said when they met on set for Silver Streak, there was an unmistakable attraction, and it carried through the four films they worked on together. And though they could dance to each other's beat and improvise like breathing, the camaraderie did not transcend off camera.
He and Richard weren't friends. They were admirers. In a way, you could say lovers, not physically, but they had a romantic affection for each other's talents. And when they were on screen, their energy was inseparable. But off screen, no, they didn't socialize at all. Whereas he and Mel saw each other at least once a week, maybe more. So it was very different, because when he worked with Richard, It was a unique intensity, because this was the only time they were going to see each other. I think I remember once Richard being present at something social, but he almost would have been Richard and him in Blazing Saddles. He was accidentally cast in Blazing Saddles, and Richard was cast away from Blazing Saddles because the insurance company wouldn't insure him playing the sheriff. And from that point on, there was this idea that at some point he and Richard would work together on screen. And first was Silver Streak, which was a great experience for him. The second was Stir Crazy, which was not a great experience for him. And then Richard had the accident. And the only time he spent real time with Richard was when Richard was recovering from having set himself on fire. They were supposed to do Trading Places together, and they didn't. They were supposed to do another movie together that they didn't do. So it wasn't until 7 years later they did See No Evil, Hear No Evil. And then that was a great experience for them. And he loved working with Richard just because they would force each other's energy in new directions and somehow always know where each other was going, even if no one else did. Like dance partners, I guess. And then another you, I was on set for, See No Evil, Hear No Evil too, but I was on set for another you, and that was just a sad experience. Not because of their lack of talents or affection, just Richard at that point wasn't well enough to make a movie, and it shows in the finished film. So he always remained grateful for his time with Richard on screen. They never became close off screen. They were extremely different people, but they always spoke highly of each other's talents.
In 1981, Gene was cast in the comedy Hanky Panky.
They say I'm crazy, just a little bit out of whack.
Sidney Poitier was looking for the woman who would be his love interest and suggested an up-and-coming star in the skit comedy show Saturday Night Live. Gene had never heard of Gilda Radner before and never saw an episode of SNL.
It didn't start out as a great romance. It started out as work and a great affinity. Gene had no idea actually who Gilda was. I think Sidney had Gene go see a play that Gilda was in. I think it was Lunch Hour. But he didn't know her, and he didn't watch Saturday Night Live, so he had no idea. So we got these tapes, 3/4-inch tapes, and he and I would watch Saturday Night Live. I had seen it, all of them. I knew exactly who Gilda was. And he thought she was fantastic, but they hadn't met. And then we were in L.A. and flying to New York, and he was nervous because he was going to meet Gilda for the first time on set the day they were filming together. And he and I met her for the first time the exact same moment. I'll never forget what she was wearing. She was wearing a white outfit, which is in the movie, and her hair was rolling and out like a lioness. And they met, and they got along, and they became closer over a few days, and she was pursuing him romantically. He wouldn't tell me because he didn't want to shock me, I suppose, because he was very naive and he assumed that I should be naive too. I was less naive, but I was creating my own friendship with Gilda. She asked if I wanted to call her Aunt Gilda, which it was also in her mind, the fantasy that she was going to get Gene to be with her. She was married at the time. And he took me out to dinner the day before my school was supposed to start. And he said, you know, the women that I've been dating, I think I should make a change and I should start dating women who are a little different and a little this and a little that, you know. And he said, a little like Gilda. And he said, but it would never be Gilda because I would never go out with a married woman. 2.5 months later, I got there for Christmas to Los Angeles to the house. And he picked me up from the airport and he said, before we go out to dinner or do anything and or take a swim, he's like, I need to tell you something. And I can't tell you when I'm driving because it's too intense. So I have to tell you when we get to the house. And he sat me on a sofa and he sat across from me and he said, remember when I told you I would never date Gilda Radner? I said, yeah. He said, well, I was wrong. And he said, we have fallen in love. And he said, but what I told you about dating a married woman is still true. It's just that her marriage is in trouble and was going to break up anyway. And I can tell you the reasons why if you want. I said, I don't need to know. He said, so you're happy. I said, I'm very happy. I love Gilda. And he said, okay. And then he called her. And she said, oh, you're happy? You're happy, Jordan? I said, yep. And the next day, she flew to California and moved in, and they dated and they broke up. They had, you know, a fiery relationship in many ways. They made each other laugh in ways that I've never seen a couple be able to make each other laugh before or since. And when they got back together, they got married, and the rest is pretty well known from that point on. I think the ability to make each other laugh is something that's not often told about them. Usually people either write about her getting sick, or they write about how they met, or they talk about would they have their marriage lasted and all that. But I can tell you as an eyewitness that they made each other laugh a lot.
In 1985, Gene began filming Haunted Honeymoon in London with his new wife.
He wanted to do something with Gilda as a romantic ingenue, which Gilda wasn't necessarily pushing for by any means. And he wanted to do a spoof of the films that he loved as a kid. The scary, some B, some not B, some wonderful films, horror movies. And he got to work on the screenplay with his very best friend in the world, Terrence Marsh.
It should have been the happiest moment of their lives, the night they came home to be married at the house of great Aunt Kate. But it turned into a haunted honeymoon.
So he and I spent that summer in London doing pre-production for Haunted Honeymoon. I remember the mansion where it was filmed. I remember so many great things that we did. We remember the movies that we saw. Everything about it was great, except for the movie. So we got all this time in London. He got to be in his favorite city, and he got to work with his best friends and his wife. And the movie just didn't turn out to be any good. And he knew it. And that was the last movie he directed. He didn't want that experience again. The only thing that haunts me is that August something, Gilda called from LA and they were worried that she had breast cancer and she had to go through a days of tests. And we were just kind of frozen waiting to find out. And then we found out that she was in the clear and we were so happy. And I remember where we went to celebrate and it was this big relief. And it haunts me because I think about it and I think about, you know, what eventually happened and how happy we were when that first diagnosis came back negative.
While trying to become pregnant, Radner was diagnosed with ovarian cancer and she died in 1989. To honor her memory, Wilder started Gilda's Club, a support group for cancer patients. After Gilda's death, Gene wasn't sure he could ever date someone again. He didn't think another person could excite or inspire him the way Gilda did. While filming See No Evil, Hear No Evil, Gene met Karen Boyer. She was a speech consultant helping him with research for the role. It would be a year until Gene was comfortable asking her to dinner, but she was the only woman on his mind the entire time.
I think the thing that scared him the most was that the neurosis he had as a late teen and in his 20s, which he found the outlet for in acting, which is the secret to his genius as an actor. I think he was frightened that somehow would come back and take a hold of him or take control of him, particularly when he didn't act anymore. It never did, but I think he was afraid of that. There was a short period in his life where he was afraid. I know it's not even right to say afraid. He was saddened and conscious of the possibility of being lonely. And his marriages pre-Gilda had not worked out very well. And in the late 70s and early 80s, he didn't find anyone that he thought he would want to marry and spend a life with. And he was not sure that he was going to ever have that again. And I can't say that I saw fear, but I did see a sense of melancholic confusion about it that even as a kid I could sense.
Gene and Karen married in a private ceremony in Wilder's home in Stamford, Connecticut, vowing to dedicate their lives to each other. They spent 25 years playing tennis, writing, and painting. During the 90s, Wilder was involved in a string of flopped movies and quickly canceled television shows. But in 1999, Wilder starred in and co-wrote A&E Television's Murder in a Small Town. It was set in 1938, and the TV movie tells the story of Cash Carter, played by Wilder. He's a successful Broadway director who leaves New York City to run a theater company in Connecticut. So he had a little bit of a personal connection to it.
He teams up with his police officer friend and becomes involved in solving the murder of a wealthy businessman. When Murder in a Small Town premiered, it became the second highest rated A&E original movie. With the thrill of the movie's success, Gene also got some very frightening news.
In 99, he had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and that just beat the hell out of him physically. And he wasn't quite physically the same after that. And that's the only time where I could see an increased aging in him, but that was physical. And Gene likely would not have survived, but for the fact that he had a stem cell transplant, which is what really, he kicked non-Hodgkin's lymphoma's ass, but this stem cell transplant really kicked his ass. And it was so new at the time, but he was diagnosed and he went through all the procedures and the treatment, and he was in remission. And the doctor, who he trusted very much, said it could come back in 6 months. And I think we should, instead of painting a great picture, we should paint a masterpiece. And that would be a stem cell transplant. And he said, then I don't think it'll ever come back. So Gene had it, but he had to be in the hospital for a month. That's how I got him to use email for the first time. He never wanted a computer. Gene was funny about technology. He poo-pooed it until he would try it, and then it was indispensable for him. And he didn't want a computer. He didn't even want to buy a computer because he said, I'm just going to use it from when I'm in the hospital. So in order to please him, we borrowed a neighbor's laptop, and I taught him how to use email so he could communicate with people, because no one could visit the hospital because they basically had to take out his immune system and put it back in. I'm not saying this correctly, but I'm saying it in general of what happened to him. And so that's how he first started to use email. Then he used email all the time. But that was, I think, 4 or 5 weeks where he was in isolation. And then it was gone.
Any apprehension to technology was dissolved, and it only supported his writing after that.
He used it for the rest of his life. He loved it. He didn't like the automation of it, you know. Same thing with, I had to get him finally to write his books and his scripts on a computer, and then he loved it, but at first he was resistant. And I think it wasn't because of ritual or habit. I remember when he wrote Young Frankenstein, it was on a long yellow legal pad, and he had very good handwriting, but there is something, I think he thought there would somehow there would be a coldness about it, that it would be the machine would interfere with what was between him and what he was trying to write. And then on email, when he realized, oh, it's just like writing letters, but I can communicate with the outside world quicker. You don't have to mail it. Then he loved it. Then he started to write his books and his scripts on a computer. And then suddenly he was like, oh, what do you use, Jordan? And I said, well, I've got a Mac. And he said, okay, let's buy 3 Macs for the houses so I can have a Mac. Then he wanted the best. Once he liked it, no, I'll never have a computer. I don't want it. And then once he liked it, he was like, well, what's the best? Let me get the best.
When the 90s came to a close, Wilder effectively retired from show business, though he did appear as a guest star on Will and Grace in 2002 and 2003.
He did do television, and I thank God for Will and Grace, because all of his experiences in television were not good until then.
I'm sorry, Mr. Truman. Does my pounding disturb you?
No, sir. Just caught me by surprise.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll try to be more considerate in the future.
He turned things down in film, and he had awful experiences on television. And then he had that Will and Grace experience, and he loved it. And he loved all the actors that worked with him. And he won an Emmy for that.
Gene hung up his acting hat after claiming, I like the show, but not the business.
He didn't care for the material that was being offered him. And he found in writing books and painting, which in later in life, painting took the place even more so than tennis of relaxing him. And he was very good. He found in writing books a quieter place. And some of that fire that drove him to the very pinnacle of his work and career had dissipated for a number of reasons, some of them good, some of them not good. But his desire to act, if something had come along, he would have done it. But he didn't have the burning desire to do it. And, you know, well, his experiences weren't good. And I don't think he really wanted to be any other place unless something great had come along. And if something great had come along, obviously, when he was still fit and felt good physically.
In 2005, he published a memoir, Kiss Me Like a Stranger, My Search for Love and Art. In an interview with Conan O'Brien, Conan turned to Gene and said, "You seem really happy." And Gene replied, "I'm the happiest I've ever been in my entire life." When Gene was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, he decided not to make it public.
He was conscious of the fact that children knew him from Willy Wonka and that he got a new generation of fans every few years. And the way he thought, if they knew, and it's not that they would say anything, but parents could whisper and say something. And he wanted that experience for kids to be genuine and to not be filtered through anything that was different or sad or would cause a complicated reaction. He didn't want to take their wonder, their sense of wonder away from them. He wouldn't want to have been the cause of one less smile, for sure. But he didn't want that under any circumstances. If he hurt somebody's feelings in his life, it would always be worse for him than the person whose feelings he hurt.
Jordan was lucky enough to be with Gene in his final moments.
He had a photo of Ella Fitzgerald and him taken in London in 1985, when we were in London for pre-production of Haunted Honeymoon. And it's one of my favorite photos of him. It was one of his favorite photos. It was everywhere in my houses. It's everywhere. It was both at his, and he loved Ella. And when he was going, I had Pandora Music on Nat King Cole radio. It wasn't even Ella Fitzgerald radio. But suddenly, you know how random Pandora is. Ella came on singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And that's he went out to that and holding my hand and holding his wife Karen's hand.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.
Gene Wilder died from complications of Alzheimer's disease on August 28th, 2016. In Stamford, Connecticut. He was 83.
I think his legacy is still being built. I think that Gene's legacy is going to grow stronger. But I think that there was a golden period of his career from 1967 to 1982, where he put some of the most multidimensional, romantic and funny, hysterical and daring performances on screen. And I think in one way, because he retired from film acting so much earlier than most successful actors do, he doesn't get his due. But at the same time, he's kind of preserved. There's no memory of him just doing stuff for the money. There's no, "Oh, that was sad. Did you see that actor? He's too old for that part." There's none of that with him. So I think he, in some ways, his prime is kind of crystallized. And I think as more people get introduced to the complete canon of his work, not just the real genius in Young Frankenstein, but the complete canon of his work, I think his legacy as an actor is going to grow exponentially. That's his legacy as an actor, as an artist. You know, everyone that met Gene, I think his legacy would be that they will think about being a little kinder and a little more tender at any given moment in their lives, because Gene always thought about approaching things from that point of view. It's easy to get angry, you know, he would say, and it's healthy, because he, for years, he didn't allow himself to get angry, and Gilda helped him with that. So he thought you should have a temper. You should be able to get angry, but to be mean or rude or spiteful, that wasn't in his nature. And his great legacy, I think, to anyone, not just me as his kid, but I mean, anyone that worked with him or knew him, even the slightest, would probably at some moment in their lives find themselves being kind where they could otherwise be mean. And I think Gene has an effect on people like that, who he's met and spent time with. Gene Wilder was an actor that when you see his work, your eyes will be dazzled and your heart will sing.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination.
Jordan Walker Perlman is a movie writer, director, and producer, and the head and co-founder of a production company called Mojo Global Arts LLC. He is producing a documentary about his uncle. Next on A Life Lived.
I remember Dan Aykroyd and I went to London to Shepperton Studios, and we watched her, you know, filming it for a while, but they were just dangling. They were just dangling in the air forever, because I guess it was that tour of Manhattan when I saw her. And her and Chris were bickering a lot, but they were also fans of each other, and she was very fond of him. You know, they had a kind of brother-sister kind of relationship.
She was beautiful, fierce, brave, complicated, and Canadian. But you have to be all of those things to stand up to Superman. I spoke with Margot Kidder's brother, John, and her best friend, Saturday Night Live comedy writer, Rosie Schuster, about the woman who made being arrested for your beliefs cool before Jane Fonda signed up to Instagram. This is an Audio Boom original production by Muddy Knees Media and Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast was presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okupniak. Our series editor has been Lucy Oliva. If there is an icon that you would like to know more about, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @alifelived_.